So this is a three-year-old girl that I met on a Saturday morning after being admitted to the pediatric surgery service because she presented to an outside hospital where she was found to have a very large abdominal mass. We knew at the beginning that she had very advanced stage disease because she presented with several months of not gaining any weight because of vomiting and not able to have a bowel movement. And it was because the tumor was blocking her GI tract completely. And these types of tumors are very fast growing. So it's actually on the radar of the surgeons, and they called me immediately with this type of diagnosis being at the forefront of what we thought she could have. What is neuroblastoma? I will just review very briefly. This is actually a very common pediatric cancer that we see. It's usually unique to pediatric patients below the age of 5. It arises in nerve tissue, and it predilects for the adrenal glands, which sit above the kidneys. So you can imagine it's actually starting in the back, and it can grow forward. It can press up on the diaphragm and make you not be able to breathe. It's a very aggressive and very, very fast-growing cancer. It can spread to the neck. It can be in the chest area, not in the lungs per se, but actually pressing on the lung and presenting many issues because you can't ventilate tumor. It also can be in the bone and in the bone marrow, and these bone tumors can be very painful. These children look very sick. They're very ill-appearing, and the parents usually come in the door knowing that something is wrong with their child more than a viral gastroenteritis, which is what they were told several times after several emergency room visits. Neuroblastoma is the most common outside of the brain tumors in children. It's more than 650 cases diagnosed each year in North America. About 37% of our cases are diagnosed as infants. 90% are younger than 5, and there's a median age of 19 months. So she is a little bit older. She was 3 when we diagnosed her. There are no racial variations in incidences. The racial differences in the tumor biology are African Americans tend to have a more high-risk disease, meaning they tend to present at a later stage with unfavorable, what we call biology factors, which can make them a more difficult group to treat. How is neuroblastoma treated? It actually has a very large spectrum. When you present as a stage 1 or 2, meaning in one area of the body and it can be cut out, those patients are actually treated with surgery alone, and they have a greater than 90% chance of beating it, and they don't get any chemotherapy. Whereas if you present at a much more aggressive stage, a stage 3 or a stage 4, we throw the kitchen sink at them. They get chemotherapy, they get radiation, they get a stem cell transplant, and we don't stop there. We actually have engineered monoclonal antibody therapy and oral chemotherapy to help prevent the neuroblastoma from coming back. Neuroblastoma continues to be one of the most debilitating diseases in pediatric cancer that we treat today, but it is also the one that we have made the most advances in the last 10 years by combining all of the research that we have put together with all of the institutions, St. Jude's, Dana-Farber, Johns Hopkins, everybody working together, CHOP, to try to help this population of patients because they seem to have some of the worst outcomes. This patient received her chemotherapy with a very good response. She had nice shrinkage of her tumor, but she did have residual tumor that lined her aorta, which is the large blood vessel that goes up and down through the middle of your body, and it was very challenging for our surgeon to get every piece of tumor tissue out because the goal is the chemotherapy shrinks the tumor down. And I always tell parents, it's like killing the roots of a tree, because you have to take the tree out before you get your transplant. Because we know that those are the patients that do the best with the transplant, with staying in remission, are those patients that have the most shrinkage from the chemo and the better surgery to get that tumor removed. Then after the transplant, they get their radiation therapy, which she did, and she had a very good response. She went into her transplant with what we call minimal residual disease. So she had the best outcomes that we could anticipate and a very good surgery. And she had her transplant. She came back to us. After radiation therapy was completed, she went on an oral Accutane vitamin A, which actually helps to prevent little tiny neuroblastoma cells. It helps to make them differentiate and die instead of staying immortal. And she did that treatment. And during that time that she was on the vitamin A, her hair grew back. She was actually able to go back to school and be with her friends and participate in school parties. And that's just something to think about. After 6 months of enjoying her life again, she had a recurrence of her neuroblastoma, and it was isolated in the bone. This was within 6 months of completing her oral Accutane, and we told her that she was in remission at that point. So 6 months later, it comes back. It actually presented in her left arm, and she was in cheerleading at the time. So they thought it was originally a cheerleading injury. She received an experimental treatment at a different hospital because we had given her everything here that we could. And that treatment did not work. She actually progressed to have more bone tumors. So that doctor referred her to another institution at a third hospital, which offered her an experimental therapy that actually was not supposed to help her, but it did. It was a phase one, and it actually reduced her tumor burden and actually gave her a very good quality of life, which I think was a miracle, I just have to say. She remained in remission for several months. Then her disease returned many months later, and now it was not only in her bone, but it was also in her bone marrow. So bone marrow is the center of the bone, and when it's there, it's kind of everywhere. It's not like it's a focal area that you can treat with radiation. It's in the bone marrow. She received another experimental therapy that was only offered at CHOP. And she actually went there and had several treatments, and she went back into remission another time. Many months had elapsed, and then again it came back in the bone and the bone marrow. The therapy that had worked previously on her, she was no longer eligible for. And the reason for that was, it was a scientific reason. It was, they used a virus and they engineered it to it so that when her body got exposed to it again, it wouldn't work. So we had no options for her. This case was discussed with her family and the patient. Now she is 10 years old. So she lived for 7 years with her neuroblastoma. After several experimental therapies going back and forth, she was at three different institutions that treat children with cancer. And at this point, she had had enough. And her mom really wanted her, she really wanted to try another chemo drug because in their eyes, some of the experimental therapies worked and gave them more time. But this particular patient did not want to lose her hair again. She wanted to go to Hershey Park with her friends. And, you know, at this point, we had been discussing with the family, and it was just a very emotional time as a physician because I actually was there when she got diagnosed. I was there for all of her relapses. So I felt like I was more than just a doctor to them. We were like a family because we had been through this whole thing together. And we discussed with them about signing a DNR and a MOLST. And the family, the mother could not do it. She felt like this was giving up on her daughter. She felt like this was killing her child. And that was a very eye-opening experience. I know that there are other physicians that feel the same way that I do. It's just very humbling to have to tell somebody and talk to them about these things at this moment in time. The patient and the family were referred to palliative care to help with her pain management. We actually were able to give her radiation therapy to the focal bone lesions that were painful so that she could go to Hershey Park and do some of the things that she wanted to do. Her last wishes were honored She was able to get a new bedroom in her house. She lived with her grandparents, and her mother was unemployed because she spent her whole life taking this patient to doctor's visits, so she couldn't have a job. And myself and my nurse practitioner went and visited her in her last days at her home, and she wanted this bedroom to be a particular way. And I'll never forget, she was in a lot of pain, and she knew we were there, and she told us to take off our shoes and not walk on her rug. So she was a very opinionated and well beyond her years, and I will never forget her. And I hope that her case will inspire you guys to think about some of the complicated issues in dealing with death of a child and how you deal with that with a family, a parent, and the medical team. Thank you.
You hear the saying that youth is wasted on the young until you hear a story about a sick child, and you know it's not. So we will introduce our panelists for today. Most of the same, but I feel like I should introduce. We have John Cagle from the School of Social Work, Dr. Stephen Zinn from the School of Medicine, Diane Hoffman from the School of Law, Mary Lynn McPherson from the School of Pharmacy, and Anita Tarzan from the School of Nursing. So let's do the same. Let's go down and everyone can give their perspective on this case, and then we can open it up to the audience for questions and comments.
Again, I'd like to first express a deep honor and appreciation to such wonderful company. I was a hospice social worker for many years, and I had difficult conversations with literally thousands of patients and families. And for me, the most challenging situations by far were when the patient was a child. And it was personally uncomfortable for me, just very emotionally challenging for me. And so I feel like there should be special awards and extra honors in the afterlife for people who do this. So thank you for just doing what you do. There are actually quite a few similarities between this morning or the earlier case and this one. And I'd like to touch on some of those similarities and maybe try to pull together some ideas for approaching such cases. Both deal with youth, young individuals, and yes, I do consider someone 35 to be young, as well as with early treatment successes. So these are individuals who responded well to therapy early on. And these early treatment successes affect decision making later on. If you have some success early on, you're more likely to continue to pursue treatment. And so how are these past successes playing into current decisions? Well, it worked in the past. Why not try it again? In both cases, the surrogates, either the husband or the parents, desired aggressive care, which may or may not be in the patient's best interest and contribute to diminished quality of life. And I think it's important to acknowledge that the two cases that we're talking about today are cases in which it was challenging for the healthcare professionals. Dilemmas aren't dilemmas if we agree. Dilemmas become dilemmas when either we have an internal debate and we may not agree with ourselves, or if we disagree with someone else's opinion. And so it's important to acknowledge that, you know, not everybody will agree with. And so there are other ways of approaching situations, and the question becomes, does everyone have the same information? Are we all on the same page? Are we well-informed? Are we well-supported? And so I'd like to throw up just a few, these are kind of personal things that I would recommend focusing on when dealing with some of these difficult situations. And the first is, when we're dealing with patients, we're not dealing with a disease. We're dealing with people. We're dealing with people who have emotional histories, personal histories, and we have to start where they are before we launch into our treatment philosophies. So it's important to start where they are. And I'm not suggesting that in this case that wasn't done. But it's important to acknowledge that these aren't just individuals with diagnoses. These are people. Education, we want to make sure that people are equipped with the information that they need in order to make decisions. And so in this case, were the parents, how did they interpret Ellie's preferences? What did they hear her say? And that sort of filtering of information through their own lens of understanding might give us, the quote-unquote clinical team, a better understanding of where the parents are coming from. Careful attention to language. When we talk about illness, end-of-life issues, language is quite often probably hyperbole, metaphors, and some of those can be misleading, even damaging. If you think about the idea of hospice or palliative care being giving up or nothing, that's not true. I do believe in the aggressive palliative care philosophy that we can mobilize multiple sources of support in order to provide care and comfort to families. And so we need to pay attention to the words that we say, because sometimes how we frame decisions can inadvertently influence the decision that gets made. Gauging expectations, asking people what they expect will happen given a particular decision. Context always matters. You need a good history, a good understanding of the spiritual beliefs, the relationships, what's happened before, because in that moment, there is a ton of history that has built up to that one moment, that interaction that you're having with them. And lastly, just again, understanding our own personal biases and preferences, because the dilemmas are dilemmas.
really gratifying to see the science can now make a difference. But it still leaves us, the physicians, with very, very difficult gut-wrenching issues. And over the 30-some years of practicing pediatric gastroenterology, where the outcomes are much better, I've learned that it is important to approach children and families with serious illness, or even terminal illness, in an interprofessional manner. I am not always the best person to communicate or get information from families. It's amazing what my nursing colleagues and my social work colleagues can tell me about what's really going on, even though I ask the same questions. And I don't get the answer. And I don't understand why, but I sort of do. And so it's important to recognize that this has to be a team effort. And as I alluded in the introduction, these discussions have to happen as the illness progresses and not in the last 24 hours, so that if there are supports in the community, if there are traditions or faiths that can help, we need to engage all of them. There are a few things that I would like to share with you about situations like this. Discussing terminal illness with children and their parents. Once a child is above the age of 2 or 3, they're smarter than we give them credit for. Taking the parents out of the room to have a conversation is really not hiding anything from those children. Interestingly and amazingly, they have incredible insights as to what's going on with them. And so the attempt to not discuss these issues with the children at some point becomes a hindrance and a detriment to moving forward. So after discussing the situation with parents and options, I think as soon as possible you can get the family to allow a discussion with the child or the patient, you have a much better chance of managing the very difficult issues that may be coming down. I also think that as a physician and as a scientist, I've spent a tremendous amount of my career in a laboratory, experimenting, trying to come up with new treatments, new approaches, new understandings. And the desire to try the newest and greatest experimental therapy is very, very strong. And it needs to be tempered by my colleagues, by social work, by pharmacy, by nursing. And I'm pleased that the field of medicine is beginning to recognize the importance of the humanities. Not that we didn't recognize them before, but I didn't get a lot of training 40 years ago in the humanities, into the human side of medicine. What I got was a drive to treat every disease, to cure every patient. And it's clear that's not possible. So it's really important for me to temper, you know, what is my instinct, which is to recommend the next new therapy that just came out, and to encourage parents and children that this information will help the next child if it may not help you, and listen to them. And so it really comes down to weighing the benefits and understanding families' needs, and particularly trying to understand what the child really wants to happen. I've been doing this for a long time. I don't know if Dr. Senior, if that was still in the audience. I haven't been doing it for quite as long as he has, but he is. So I want you to know, Mark, that these continue to be difficult conversations, and in truth, they become more difficult as I grow older, because
So, again, I'm Diane Hoffman from the School of Law, and again, the question for me is, what is the law add to this kind of case? And so, nice follow-up from Dr. Chen, because really what's different about this is the issue, from a legal perspective, is the allocation of decision-making between the parent and the child. Does the child have any legal rights here? What are the parents' limits of their authority? So this is another, well, the situation of minor decision-making is not as well, for end of life, not as well spelled out as it is for adults. I mean, Maryland, the Healthcare Decisions Act that I talked to you about, for the most part, doesn't apply to minors. It really applies to adults. And what we have here is a similar tension in the law, in the underlying constitutional rights and values that are at play here. On the one hand, minors have rights to bodily integrity. That right really came out of the Supreme Court cases on abortion and minors. But we also have a very strong constitutional right that's given to parents and the privacy of the family and parental decision making for what's to be done about their children, for their children. Just to give you a sense of that, there was a 1979 Supreme Court case involving a parent's decision to admit a minor to a mental hospital. And the court held that even though a minor has a liberty interest in not being confined as unnecessarily for medical treatment, parents retain a substantial, if not dominant, role in the decision, absent a finding of abuse or neglect. The court observed that most children, even in adolescence, simply are not able to make sound judgments concerning many decisions, including their need for medical care or treatment, and that parents can and must make those decisions. Also, this comes out of the view that parents will act in the best interest of their children, and that the state should step in and make that decision, that they are not an adequate surrogate for the judgment of a loving, nurturing parent. Some people have criticized that opinion as not giving sufficient attention to the rights of the child, but the courts are generally hesitant to interfere with parental decision-making in these cases. States have carved out areas where minors can make their own medical decisions, but they're very explicitly and somewhat narrowly circumscribed. These have been involve areas where the children are reluctant to talk to their parents. And if you made them go through their parents, they probably wouldn't get treatment. So there are things like medical care for pregnancy, for contraception, for treatment of STDs, for substance abuse, for mental health. In Maryland, our statute identifies 7 circumstances under which any minor has the same capacity as an adult to consent to medical treatment. And those are primarily those are drug abuse, alcoholism, venereal disease, pregnancy, contraception, probably sterilization, physical exam, and treatment related to rape or sexual effects. Another area that states have carved out is for emancipated minors. And these are generally minors that are found to be independent of their parents, such as minors who are living on their own and supporting themselves, or minors who are married or in the military. In Maryland, an emancipated minor is one who is married or the parent of a child. And in the case of, actually, one thing the Healthcare Decisions Act does say that in the case of an emancipated minor, they have the same capacity as an adult to consent to medical treatment, and they may also execute an advance directive under the Healthcare Decisions Act. This case doesn't fall within any of those. So what the law also has established, primarily through the courts and judicial decision-making, are exceptions to the general rule of parental decision-making. If you have a mature minor, the difficulty becomes in deciding what is that. And that's something, again, that physicians or healthcare providers are in the position of trying to decide. Generally, what the law says is that a mature minor is one who is capable of appreciating the nature, extent, and probable consequences of conduct consented to, or who has the ability of an average person to understand and weigh the benefits of treatment. So just to give you some other background about the kinds of cases. informed when deciding whether to permit a teenager to refuse life-sustaining therapies. Many factors come into play, including the basis for the refusal. In the case of faith-based refusals, so you have some individuals who are related to Christian Science or co-religious who are not, will not accept traditional medical care, the courts have said that parents are free to become martyrs, but they may not make their children martyrs. So the courts are going to scrutinize very much a child who is basing their decision on religious beliefs, is it really truly their religious beliefs, or are they being coerced by their parents. There was a case, of course, also consider whether their parents agree with the child, and if the child is refusing to apply for any treatment. There was a case in which a 17-year-old teen's religious beliefs led her to refuse a medically necessary transfusion. The Illinois Supreme Court in that case overturned the judgment of a lower court and allowed the teen to refuse treatment. That was in 1989. But the court was largely swayed by the fact that the parents agreed with the child's decision. There was a case in West Virginia where the appellate court remanded the case to the trial court to determine whether a 17-year-old was able to consent to a do-not-resuscitate order. The West Virginia court observed that the issue of whether a child is a mature minor is a question of fact, whether the child has the capacity to consent depends upon the age, ability, experience, education, training, and degree of maturity of judgment obtained by the child, as well as upon the conduct and demeanor of the child at the time of the procedure or treatment, and whether the minor has the capacity to appreciate the nature, risks, and consequences of the medical procedure to be performed or the treatment to be administered to or withheld. Maryland courts actually have not dealt with the issue of a mature minor. We don't have an opinion from a court in Maryland regarding with respect to medical decision making, whether a child is mature enough to make certain medical decisions. We do have a Maryland Attorney General opinion that noted and gave support to the notion that under the common law, judge-made law, a minor can demonstrate that he or she is mature enough to understand the consequences of a medical procedure. The minor can give the required informed consent. That opinion was, though, in the context of a minor in an adult correctional institution, and whether the facility had to obtain the consent of parents of the prisoner prior to providing them medical care. So I think in Maryland, I would say that it was likely that our courts would recognize this doctrine of mature minor, but we don't really have a lot of law in Maryland. I would say the bottom line is assuming.
That's a big one. So some of them are common ones written here that I'd like to go over. Taking opiate or increasing the dose means the end is near. Along with that is, if the end is near, morphine or others can't be increased without causing death. This actually has been proven in clinical trials not to be the case. Dr. Russell Portnoy from New York commissioned a huge study to the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization looking at, I don't know, like 1,500 patients, looking at the absolute milligram number of morphine or morphine equivalents, and they also looked at the time from the last time they increased the opioid dose to the time of death, and there was absolutely no correlation. So it did not hasten death. That's the first thing that came out of somebody's mouth. Addiction to opioids is very common and occurs easily. I get this in the outpatient practice, in hospice, everybody and their mothers are afraid of addiction. That's actually reassuring to me. If they're afraid they're going to get addicted, I should feel better about the whole thing. So the question I ask is, okay, I recognize your fear. Certainly you can't turn on the TV without hearing about these crazy people who abuse and divert drugs, and a lot of that's criminal intent. It's a career move. I mean, because you're so happy to tell you how much you can get for an oxytocin treat. Beat your hands off of being a fat lady for a lot of money. But importantly, I ask the question, so have you ever had a dental procedure and got maybe a dozen Percocet? Yes. How did you do? Okay. How did it make you feel? It made me feel stupid. I took one and I didn't want to take them anymore. So my point is, you did not go crazy with the other 11, run up the street and try to sell them. No, it did not. So then I'm not as worried that you're probably going to become addicted and, you know, end up being institutionalized or something. So, but we do have to address that because we do know that about 20% of Americans are abusing and diverting medications. This is a serious issue, but far less likely than people are concerned. Pain medication can and should only be prescribed and given to patients when the pain occurs. It's the exact opposite. People with persistent pain, whether it's a child, an adult, I don't care who it is, if they have persistent pain, which is defined as pain that's present at least 12 or 24 hours, it is far better to prevent the pain than to treat the pain when it occurs. It takes far less drug to do that, and people are more functional. Often I have to talk to patients who are recovered drug abusers who now have a terminal illness and they are terrified of going on an opioid. This actually is in your best interest to treat the pain because there are physiologic consequences to undertreated pain. Immunologic changes, your sympathetic nervous system is always on red alert, it's just not a good look. Pain is an unavoidable part of any illness. No, that's not true. And using very simple measures, with 95% of pain, we can control. There certainly are the extraordinary cases that end up in our inpatient units in hospitals where we have to do really crazy things like ketamine and things like that, but the vast majority of patients, we can get the job done. The only way you can treat pain is with an injection. That's not true. One of my favorite pharmaceutical formulations is called Intensol. It's a highly concentrated oral solution of a medication. We have morphine, oxycodone, 20 milligrams per mil. We have methadone, 10 milligrams per mil. You can put up to 1 mL in the buccal cavity, even in somebody who's completely unconscious, a child even. Prop their upper body up a little bit, and they won't aspirate it. We can keep them comfortable till they draw their very last breath. The side effects can kill a patient. Well, that's true. I mean, if you really push the dose, you can give somebody respiratory depression. But, you know, our hospice nurses, I personally think, now, of course, I am obscenely biased. I think nobody does pain and palliative care like hospice people. Oh, my God, they eat the stuff for life. Nurses can do things like say, you will not be able to swallow in 10 days, 12 hours, and 14 minutes, and they also move ahead of time to make sure you will continue to get your medication in a way that we can get it into you and it will get the job done. So they absolutely bring their A-game and monitor the adverse effects and they counsel the patient, the families, the caregivers, what to watch for, when to call me, and here's what we're going to do. You ask any card-carrying hospice nurse when you've grown the most is when he or she hears you're admitting a retired Marine. Oh, no. Oh, and a guy with your boots on. So it's really difficult. And that's along with the same philosophy of, if I suffer more, I'll go to heaven. No pain, no gain. Baloney. I don't care what religion you are. I think that's malarkey. And allegedly, doctors have to choose between treating a disease and treating the pain. And we know that's baloney, too. You can do both. Our GI docs over here, we're getting over the ER philosophy of we can't treat the pain because we'll obscure the diagnosis. I think even that's kind of going away a little bit. So I think it's important that as healthcare practitioners and members of the extended team, we're familiar with these myths and misconceptions. We train our nursing assistants and our volunteers about these myths and misconceptions and how to have those conversations. Thank you.
That was excellent.
Got it?
Rumi quote. Does anyone know who Rumi is? 13th century Persian poet and Sufi mystic. So when we're talking about a child dying, we're in a whole different territory emotionally and spiritually and anything else you can think of as far as helping families through that. So we have to proceed cautiously. And I'm reminded of a quote of a Zen koan. It was a story of a Zen master whose son had died. And the Zen master's student saw this master crying and distraught over his son's death. And they said, "Teacher, you told us that death is an illusion, that the body is impermanent, and that we transcend suffering by releasing our attachment to impermanence. Why do you then suffer so at your son's death?" Now, there's two versions to this teacher's response. One is, yes, death is an illusion, and the death of a child is the greatest illusion of all. The other is attachment, no, sadness, which is that being in the moment, this Buddhist practice of feeling what you're feeling in the moment, letting it go, not being a sponge, requires, again, this ability to stay present to others' suffering. And that's no more true than I think when we're dealing with parents facing life-threatening illness in a child. And I think it was pointed out, too, that I did hospice when we would have a child admitted. Most of the hospice nurses would kind of go, "Not me, I'm not taking the child." So there is something different about, and I know there's a probably hospice providers in the audience who would beg to differ, but there is a special person who could deal with a child who's terminally ill. It's harder to also, I think, predict outcomes in children, as we've heard. So this probably accounts for some of that. But also just this idea that clinicians, physicians in particular, are taught to cure, and not being able to do anything more treatment-wise feels like they're not able to do anything. But we've heard stories already of people who have survived someone else dying, when it went well, when it went poorly, that still impact them throughout their lives. And I always tell my nursing students, the slightest kindness when people are vulnerable gets magnified times 100. And the slightest disrespect or disregard gets magnified times 100. So we have an opportunity to make a real impact, hopefully for the better. And this other chart that I showed of the relationship between palliative care and curative care, I think, is especially true in pediatrics. Whether we're talking about, in this case, oncology in the pediatric intensive care unit or even in the neonatal intensive care unit, there's this sense that palliative care is the death squad, and you don't call them in until you really need them. And what that does is not only it cuts families off from the skills and expertise that they have to share, the whole holistic mind, body, spirit support that we have to give. And it also sets up the palliative care team for being the ones that come in late in the game. You're trying to play catch up, and the families get kind of emotionally whiplashed by if that happens in that way, by having this other team come in, and it's like, well, why didn't my other doctors tell me any of this, and who are you? You just had this negative point of view. So I think we could do much better bringing that team in earlier. The other is this idea of trust, and we talked about that today too. This is a quote from a program coordinator for palliative care program in Washington. And she's talking here about POLST. This is the Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment form. Maryland has a MOLST version of that. That's medical orders, because physician's assistants and nurse practitioners can sign it. This translates someone's advanced directive into current orders that are transportable from one facility to the next. And she says here, it's essential to ensure that some level of trust and rapport has been established with the family before conversation begins about POLST, while also assessing cultural considerations and the context of familial hope. Pushing this discussion is not effective or helpful in assuring best patient care. Well, somebody could take that quote and say, see, they said on the quote that I didn't have to have this conversation, and that's not my point here. It needs to be done earlier. It needs to be done skillfully, and it needs to be timed well. So we talked a little bit about this idea of informed consent, and these are just the different elements of any time a clinician wants to provide a procedure to a patient, they have to get either the patient's or their surrogate's informed consent for the procedure, and that requires these three elements. The person has to be able to understand relevant information in terms that they can understand, not in medical speak. They have to be able to appreciate the consequences, to reason about the pros and cons. And what happens, too, is that if we're, again, waiting too long and having these discussions in moments of crisis, it's much harder to process all of the facts that you need to make an informed choice. A couple of other little things about informed consent, just Randy Curtis has a concept that he calls, I think it's informed non-dissent, which is that sometimes we burden patients, or families, surrogate decision makers, with like it's a menu of choices. So what would you like? Here are your options. Instead of saying, like, would you ever think of a car mechanic saying, well, I could do a transmission or I could do a oil and filter change. What would you like? Well, you want the car mechanic to tell you what do you think I should have. Now that, again, we heard other stories where that can go wrong. So there's this idea of trust involved. But this idea that maybe we overburden people by making them perceive that they're making this choice themselves instead of it being a recommendation from the team who's expert in what's going on with that patient. The other is this concept of limited trials. And I think technology in the 21st century is just moving so quickly. There's so much more that we can do that predicting how a patient will do is getting harder and harder. So it really supports this concept of, okay, we're looking for one in a million, let's try it, and if it doesn't work, let's take it away. Now, in ethics, we don't see a distinction between withholding and withdrawing, ethically speaking. It can feel different emotionally, and there are different religious beliefs that might preclude stopping something that you've already started. But I would make the argument that it's more pro-life to try something, to start it, and then stop it later than it is to not start it at all and not have that opportunity for some benefit. And I just wanted to say a couple other words about chronic illness versus terminal illness, and especially in children. So the members of the disability community are quick to point out that there are plenty of children who are disabled, either physically or mentally, maybe devastatingly disabled neurologically, and stable, not dying. And their family is happy with that condition, and they want to keep them in the family, and they're not interested in withdrawing treatment to allow them to die. So this idea of what do we mean by dying is an important one. This is actually an article about in adults, but this concept that you have to make a distinction between someone who is disabled and when a disabled person even is dying. So this progressive deterioration, that the body is failing, and you're not making a decision based on a judgment about the quality of life of that individual. Obviously easier said than done because of the technology that we have. This is just a position statement from the American Association on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. They identify criteria as guidelines for when continued life support may not be in the best interest of an individual, and that would be when treatment would be ineffective, we've talked about that already, only prolongs dying, a state of irreversible coma or permanent vegetative state, and the other links I provided have interesting information about people with disorders of consciousness that would be relevant to that question. And also just this idea that treatment itself would impose excessive pain and suffering, and again, weighing benefits and burdens. So just to end with this reminder that we're treating the patient, and in palliative care and hospice, we're always treating the patient in the context of the loved one surrounding the patient. In this case, it maybe is a little bit more complicated because it's the question of whether the patient can make decisions for herself and how that would work in the context of the parents as decision makers. But we're also treating the loved one surrounding the patient. We're treating them now and how they're coping. The whole family is coping. Because we know that disease impacts everybody in the family. And as you heard poignantly described by the person who spoke last in our Q&A, the way that we treat and handle these experiences really does stay with people. And so we're actually also trying to treat the survivors and their future selves, and ideally in a way that minimizes their distress and their regrets. So again, we'll tell you by the end of today where we're going to post these. We'll have a link. These are just another set of resources that you can refer to for more information. Thank you.
All right, so